All right, so we are holding Samachet Amud Beis 12 lines from the bottom, winding in the Torah. Okay, we mentioned in our Mishnah, you have a question if a Zav or Zava, et cetera, die. At what point do we say that the concept of Tumas Evan Nesama doesn't apply to them anymore? Where we said that if, suppose, for example, that the body is on top of an Evan Nesama, a very heavy stone, and you have Kalim underneath the stone, if the Zav is alive, then the Kalim become Tame. That's a special din that applies to a Zav and the other and these other Tmeim that I mentioned in the Mishnah. But at what point does it stop applying after they die? So we said when they start when they start decaying.
And that's because of what?
Because we said there is the tumma of them exists daraisa. And we said the problem is that we don't just want the special tumma of Evan Masama to go away as soon as they die, because they may actually have only fainted and somebody mistakenly thinks that they died. The truth is, by the way, actually, we didn't talk about this yesterday, but there is a braisa elsewhere that implies that there's actually a machlokas on that subject. Do we say that the tumma of the Zav continues to exist even on a daraisa level after they die until the body starts decaying, or until the body not starts decaying or whatever, until maybe the body has even reached an advanced stage of decay or whatever? Or do we say the whole thing is only Dirabbanan, as our Gemara is saying over here, because the person may have fainted and people mistakenly think he's dead? Okay, in any case, you have this concept that even after... So right, but in any case, the point is, even after the Zav is dead, the tumma still continues to exist until they start decaying, or we said Rabbi Eliezer says it has to be a little further along until the stomach bursts open. Okay. So the Gemara is now going to mention a bunch of questions that the people of Alexandria asked Rabbi Yeshua, and this was the first one of them. So therefore, we have a whole Gemara about that. The Gemara says, Tana Rabbam, Shneim Osa Dvarim Shalom Anshe Alexandria as Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya. Chinina, it says over here, it's supposed to be Hananya. The people of Alexandria asked Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya 12 questions. The Pashtus, these Anshe Alexandria, are Jews, as we're going to see. The first three questions were in complicated cases of halacha. So the Pashtus, they were local Jews who knew their way around Torah, and they're asking good questions. Gimel Divrei Chochma, the first three are questions of Chochma. Rashi explains Chochma means halacha. One idea is, I think the Aruch HaNer says, so why don't we just say halacha? Because these are not just such straightforward halacha. No, they're just the Rashi, Divrei Chochma, halacha is actually a very short Rashi. But I'm not sure, they're down here. You're looking at a Tosfos. Well, Tosfos has a long discussion over here. Rashi, okay, anyway. No, the point is, in other words, these are not just straightforward questions in halacha. These are complex cases in halacha, as we're going to see. Some of them are more complex than others. We're going to see that we're going to spend most of Daf Ayin talking about one of them. So that's why we call them chachma. Like, it's not just straightforward halacha. It's the chachma within halacha. Okay, so three questions of chachma. Gimel Divrei Haggadah, three questions of Haggadah. Specifically, as we're going to see on Omer Beis, these are questions about how Hashem runs the world, how Hashem deals with people, and how he runs with the world. Gimel Divrei Burus, three of them are words of Burus, which actually translates Burus as shtus, nonsense. Now why are we asked? So we'll get to that. And Gimel Divrei Derech Eretz, and they ask three questions on Derech Eretz, on proper behavior.
And why the Bruce comes before the Derech Eretz?
Ah, so actually, the Marsha has an explanation over here. He says that basically these represent four different aspects of Torah. There's Halacha, there's Agadza, which is to understand, there's Agadza specifically, specifically, in other words, Agadza, we're calling it Agadza because these kinds of things, like of how Hashem runs the world, how Hashem deals with people, the Chachamim hid all over the place in Agadza. We have the famous thing that I've never mentioned in Igeres HaKodesh, that most secrets of the Torah are concealed within Agadza. So therefore, such topics can be categorized as words of Agadza. Then you have the Divrei Burus. Marsha explains over here, and we'll talk about later other explanations, but Marsha over here understands that the Divrei Burus involve philosophy. So the questions, the three questions that they ask of Divrei Burus, which we'll get to later, their questions are predicated on the Greek philosophy that they have learned. Alexandria, after all, was a center of Greek philosophy in those days. But on the other hand, it's Divrei Burus because relative to the Torah, those philosophical chokhmas are not really worth much. And he points out to them that in each case, those are mistaken premises that your philosophy is teaching you, which in fact the Torah is not like that. because we still need to know that they asked them. But with that said, though, I'll tell you later on when we get there, there's a sicha in Chelik Yudches where the Rebbe analyzes these Shlosha Divrei Burus and explains it's not so simple. Actually, those questions turns out that the premises of their questions, on the face of it, they're within total logic. They have substance to them. On the other hand, they're called divrei burus because in the end, in the final analysis, it turns out whichever side of the question you take, the result is going to be the same. So it's divrei. So in other words, no. So, but on the surface, there is. On the surface, that ever points out in the Sifa. In general, you have many places in Torah. We have many places in Gemara. We've had many times before. We have Tzedukim arguing with the Chachamim, you have whatever. I mean, you know, you're not going to have, the Gemara is not going to record a stupid question that somebody asked the Chachamim, that like, you know, because then there's no point of recording it for all time. If we're recording it for all time, it means there's some more substance there than seems at first glance. So here is Dibrei Burus relative to the truth of Torah, but on the other hand, in its own way, it has a certain substance and a certain logic there.
Only superficially Dibrei Burus.
Right. Well, no, the other way around. Superficially, it seems to be a deep question. When you delve into it, and you look, hello, when you delve into it, and you look into the actual, then you realize it's Dibrei Burus. With that said, by the way, it's interesting. One of the Mephoshim says all three questions. When we get to these three divrei burus, all of them are questions involving tum of atara of mesis. So he says maybe the word is not burus as in boorishness, as in ignorance, but rather burus as in pits, like things that have to do with dead people that are in pits. Okay, anyway. And Gimel Divrei Derech Eretz. So that's what Marashal says. He has four aspects of Torah. You have halacha, what you have to do and not do on a daily basis. You have agadta, to understand how Hashem runs the world, etc., and how Hashem interfaces with us. You have Divrei Burus, which, okay, involves philosophy, which we have to know what parts of philosophy are compatible with Torah and whatnot. And Derech Eretz, that the Torah teaches you what the proper behavior is, Verecheret means over here that the proper ways of behaving in the world. Like, we're going to get to them later. But anyway, so that's why they ask these four things, because they want to know about each of these four aspects of Torah, of what Torah has to teach us. Number one, Gimel Divrei Chochmah. The three questions of Chochmah were as follows. Question number one was the case we have in our Mishnah. Hazov, v'hazov, v'anidah, v'yeledet, v'amathurda, shemesu. Any of these five Kneim who die, admosei metamin b'masa. Up until what point are they still metamin b'masa? Which, as we said before, does not refer to actually carrying the dead body, because obviously then it's metame just as by virtue of being a dead body. But rather, up until what point does the concept of Evan Mitzoma still apply, that if the body is on one side of a, is on one side of a heavy rock and Kalim on the other side of it, that they become Tomei.
Only about Evan the
Summer. Only about Evan the Summer, right, because if it's talking about regular Masa, when they're alive, they're Matame because they're a job, and when they're dead, they're Matame because they're a dead body, right. And he answers them the answer that we gave in the Mishnah, according to the Chachamim, not according to the other, which is that when the flesh decays. Okay, I mean, they asked Rabbi Yeshua, and later on it was recorded in our Mishnah. One possibility is, given what I was saying before, that you have a braisa that says there's actually a machloikas on the subject, whether this concept of them of it being the tame after they're dead is daraisa or derabanan, they may have been asking based on that. If it's daraisa, then it wouldn't necessarily be when the body first starts decaying. You may have to wait until it reaches a more advanced stage of decay. Whereas if you say it's only derabanan in case the person might have fainted, so that would have been the question. Okay. Second question is a little bit more complicated. Bas Meshulachas Mahi Lakoyim. We know like this. The Torah tells us that when a man has divorced his wife, if she remarries, if her second husband dies or divorces her, she's not allowed to remarry her first husband. Lo yuchabal arishin ashashucha, lo shuv lakasa. It's in Kiseta, right? So such a case is called Meshulachas, because she was sent away, as the prophet uses the expression, Meshulcha Mibesa. He gives you a gift. So now, if she was, so suppose you have them. Reuben was married to a woman. They got divorced. He gave her a get. She went and married Shimon. Shimon died or divorced her. Reuben illegally remarried her, which was against halacha. Now, what happened?
Children
So the question is, bas mishloachas mahi l'kayin. Not so much as far as mamzerus. No, because mamzerus is a different issue. There we know they have a machlokas in Yevamos. What kinds of relationships produce mamzerim? The halacha is only krisis or mitzvah based in. This is neither of the above. This is an isur lav. So it wouldn't produce a mamzer. But the question is, suppose they have a daughter. Is she also to marry a kayin? The question is like this: Mi amrin and kavachomer. We might argue we have a kavachomer as follows: Uma almana lekoyin gadol, madach an almana who is only a widow who is only also to a kohen gadol, she'en istur d'shava b'kohel, and that istur does not equally apply to all the kohenim because only the kohen gadol is prohibited from marrying an almana, and yet b'na pogum, and yet if they have a son together. Then that child is a cholol, or if it's a daughter, then it's a cholola. So in other words, if a kohen gadol marries or has relations, whatever, with an almana, the child is going to be a cholol, even though it's an issur that doesn't apply to everybody. It only applies to the kohen gadol. Zoo, this case of the mishalachas sheisur a shava b'kohel, where the issur applies equally to all Jews. No Jew who divorced his wife is allowed to remarry her. Maybe ain't a din shabna pogum. Maybe we'd say then a kavachomer that the child should be considered pogum, meaning a halala, and therefore also to marry a kohen. Or maybe you would say, on the other hand, mala amana the kohen gadol, mala amana the kohen gadol. Yes, but how do you think to prove it from the case of amana the kohen gadol? The point is, shehi asma mishalala. What happens is, if the kohen gadol marries an amana and has relations with her, she herself now becomes a halala. What does that mean? First of all, it means that if he dies, she's not allowed to marry a regular kohen, whereas up until now, being a widow, she was also to marry a kohen gadol, but she would have been mutter to marry any other kohen. So the fact that the kohen gadol had relations with her was machal of her. Number two, also Rashi says, if she herself was a bas kohen, up until this point, she would have been allowed, after her husband died or divorced her, if she doesn't have children from him, she would have been allowed to go back and eat truma from her father's house. Now, if she becomes a halala, then that's also. So that she can't. She's a halala, so she can't marry. She can't marry any kohen, right? So then, in that case, so maybe therefore, because you have that chumrah in her, that she herself is mishalalas. Therefore, you say, okay, well then, therefore, even though it's not an issue, a shava b'koil, nevertheless, we say it still affects the child, but not necessarily with a bas mishalachas. The mishalachas is not becoming any more pogrom than before. She's already a grusha, so she anyway can't marry a kohen. As far as the fact Tosfos discusses over here, based on a Gemara and Yevamos, as far as the fact that you could argue, well, didn't she have relations with somebody who was also to her? Wouldn't that topple her from truma? Suppose she was a bas kohen. The answer is no, because that only applies to somebody who. That doesn't apply when she's remarried to the same husband that she had before, even though he wasn't allowed to marry her in this case because she's been married to somebody else in between. Nevertheless, he can't be called posula. The expression Tosfos brings is the lav zor meikra hu esla. He's not initially a zor by her. In other words, when do we say you have a bas kohen, it has relations with somebody, and that topples her from ever eating truma from her father's house again? That would only be if that person that she had relations with is somebody where the iser to have relations with him exists to begin with. But not over here, because the first time she married him, there was no iser. They were perfectly legally married. It's only the second time that there is. So therefore, he doesn't topple. So therefore, his bia doesn't topple her from truma. So therefore, you could say that you have a kula when it comes to the mishalacha. So on the one hand, you have a chumrah over the almana l'kohen gadol, because mishalachas applies to all Jews, and almana applies only to the kohen gadol. On the other hand, the almana herself becomes a halala, the mishalachas doesn't. So what's the din as far as the child? Is she mutter to marry a kohen or not? I just said, the fact that she doesn't become also to marry a kohen, because she's anyway a megoresh, she's anyway a divorced woman, she's not allowed to marry any other kohen. The only thing that it could do, the only thing that being a mishalachas could do, theoretically, would be to passel her from eating truma from her father's house. So again, continuing our scenario, let's say Reuven illegally married her. Then let's say Reuven now dies. She has no children from him. She has no children from Shimon, the interim husband. Then we should say maybe that she shouldn't be able to go back to eating truma. No, we won't say that because Reuven was not zor me'ikra esmasu. Reuben was not somebody who was usher to have relations with her to begin with. The issue only came about later on after she married Shimon, and that's not the type that would pass all her from eating Truma. Okay, Tosfos actually gets into a bit of discussion why indeed we don't say maybe the Kal V'Chomer should tell us that she should be Mischalel, and Tosfos gets into a long discussion about the pros and cons of that. But the question of the Anshei Alexandria is something else. Tosfos's question is, why indeed don't we say on the basis of this Kal V'Chomer, let's say that she herself is Mischalel, that in fact we say, granted, Reuben is not Zor Me'ikre Esla, but this Kal V'Chomer should nevertheless say, because Meshulach has applies to everybody and Almon Lekoyim Gadol does not, we should say, therefore, that she does in fact become Mischalel. Okay, so Tosfos gets into some discussion, why indeed not. But the bottom line is that not. Okay, anyway, the point is, so that's the question. You would think she should be, but we don't use the Kal V'Chomer for that purpose, basically. Okay, so the question is then, so again, the question is not so much about the woman herself. The question is rather about the daughter. Is she a Chalala or not? Amalahen. So he says to them, the answer is, the pasuk describes when this case of a man who divorced his wife and then later on remarries her after she was married to somebody else in between. The expression in the pasuk is ki to'eber he, it or she is a repulsive thing for Hashem, meaning he to'eber, the word he is a mute. Only she is to'eber, ve'en boneha to'eber. Her children are not considered to'eber, so therefore the answer is that no, her child is not considered a cholol, and her child, her daughter, if it was a daughter, would in fact be able to marry a kohen.
One second. For the kohen gadol, she's also to'eber.
No. The an almono of a kohen gadol doesn't say the word teyefa over there. It just says a kohen gadol is not allowed to marry an almono. Almono grush of a halal zane. The pasuk doesn't use the word teyefa by it. But in any case, you don't have a miut from the word he over there. You don't have a miut from the word he over there. Yasso, close the door, please, would you? Thank you. The point is, there you don't have a miut. Here you have a mute to say that the whole concept of Te'eva only applies to her, not to the child. Tosfos actually asks the question the other way around. Now that we said the Kal V'Chomer doesn't work for our purposes, then why do we even need a pasuk to say that he Te'eva, ve'en bonel Te'eva? And we anyway said that there's a way to slug up the Kal V'Chomer because we said that Almona L'Kohen Gadol has a severity which Meshulachas does not, because Almona L'Kohen Gadol becomes a Chalala and Meshulachas does not. Okay, so Tosfos again gets into a bit of discussion about that. One thing is that indeed maybe we actually primarily use this drasha of he te'eva ve'en bonel te'evin. We use it maybe for some other cases involving yevamos and whatever. Anyway, the point is Rabbi Yeshua answers them. So the answer to your question is that no, the daughter of the Meshulachas is not also Terukayim. Okay. The third question they asked him is the most complicated of all. Suppose you have two mitzrayim whose korbanos, the animals for their korbanos, got mixed up with each other. Now we know which one is which type of korban. Because the three korbanos that a mitzvah brings, he has to bring an oshom, a chatos, and an oila. He brings a male sheep for an oila, a female sheep for the chatos, and he brings I forgot what the three animals are. But here, let's look real quick and find. Okay, so there's going to be a difference, as we're going to see, between a rich mitzvah and a poor mitzvah. But to start with a rich mitzvah that we're talking about, he brings like this. Okay, he has two sheep, one for an ola and one for an osham, and he brings two male sheep, which he brings for a chatos. So let's say two male sheep and one female sheep. Yeah, all of them under a year old. Okay, now let's say he also brings with it the menachas that go along with them, plus one extra log of oil. So let's say now these animals that Reuben and Shimon are both mitzrayim, they both brought their animals for korbanos, and now we mixed up. We don't know whose animals are whose. Now, let's say we're talking about, we're not sure whether this particular animal is the one for the oila, or for the asha. We know that this one is for the oila, we know this one is for the asha. The problem is, we mixed up, we don't know, is this one Reuven's or is this one Shimon's? Now, what happened is, the korav korbanei shel echad mehem, suppose that now one of them had his chasas brought on his behalf, umes echad mehen, and then what's it now? If they were still alive, then there's no problem. If they're both alive, there's no problem. Given that we know that we have among these animals over here, we have this one is definitely a chasas, and that one is definitely a chasas, no problem. We bring the first one on behalf of whichever one it belongs to. If this is Reuven's, then it goes for Reuven. If it's Shimon's, it goes for Shimon. And the other one, the same thing. The problem is now, mes echad mehen. The wrinkle is now that one of these mitzrayim died. So now you have a problem. Now what do? So Shimon died, let's say. So now what do we do with Reuven? We can't say that we're going to bring the second chasas because maybe the first one was already Reuven's, the second one is Shimon's, and we know a chasas whose owner died, we learned in Masechta Tzmura, is a chasas hamesa. You have to leave it to die. You can't say, let's say you're going to say, if I'm required to bring this, then good, and if not, I'm bringing it as an adava. You can't bring a chasas as an adava. So what do? Again, you can't just say, in other words, that you can't say, let's say, okay, so again, if both of them were alive and we were makriv one, and if both of them were alive and we were makriv one and now we have the other, okay, we can be makriv the other. If we had a case where, let's say, both of them die, fine, both of them are chatoris hamesis. So then no problem, you leave them both to die. But here, what do you do? What do you do in order to, the problem is also, you can't also say, okay, well then let's say like this, one of them we already offered, the other one, fine, we'll consider it to be on the safe side of chatoris hamesis, and then let's say Reuven is still alive, we'll bring another animal, can't do that either. What if the first one that we brought was already Reuven's? And now we can't bring a second one on behalf of Reuven.
In any case, one second. We said...
One second. Okay. Yeah, let's continue.
You getting the share?
Yeah, we're in the middle.
Okay.
Right, I'll look at the top, yeah. Yeah.
We always said you cannot offer a carbon for something. When does it suffer?
That's the question. So what do we do? The problem is like this. Unless we bring this the tzaras chatas, he will never be able. He's always going to be a mechoser kapara. He will never be able to eat truma. He will never be able to eat kodshim. He will never be able to enter the bis mikdash. So what do we do in order to fix him up that in the future he should be able to? How do we go about bringing a chatas on his behalf when we have this stuff? So Hasheni Matahele, what kind of tnai? You can't make a tnai over here. You can't say if the previous one was mine, then this one. I'm bringing this one as a chasas nedava, because you can't bring a chasas as a nedava. You can't say if the previous one was mine, then we'll leave this one to die and I'll bring another one. Same thing. Maybe this one was, if this one was his, then he can't bring a second one.
You say if the previous one was mine, then the other one is the next.
Then he's dead. You can't bring a chasas on behalf of a dead person. So what do you do? Hasheni Matahei Olav. So what do we do for the second one? What do we do for Reuven in this case? Shimon's dead. What do we do for Reuven to make it possible for him to ever eat Korbanos, to eat Kodshim, or enter the Mitzmikdash again? Amalehem, so Rabbi Yeshua answers them, Koisev Nechosev L'Acherim. What Reuven should do is he should write out a document that he's signing away all of his property to somebody else. Bahavi Oni, at that point he is considered an Oni. And now maybe Chata Sa'oif, a Baal Asafik. Now we change things. Now he's an Oni, and the Torah tells us for a Masoda who's an Oni, he doesn't bring three animals. He brings one animal for an Asham, a sheep, same male sheep as he would have before. Instead of the two female sheep for Ola and Chatas, instead he's bringing two birds, one for an Ola and one for a Chata. Good, a Chata Sa'oif can be brought for a Safik. So therefore, so we do that. Obviously, we make him an Oni. Right. Obviously, what we want to do is we want to make sure that obviously he wants to make sure the person he's going to sign over all his property to is going to be a friend of his who's going to be willing to give it all back afterwards. And he wouldn't want to just give it over to some random person who might then say, good, well, I have all your property. I'm keeping it. No. But obviously, he's going to make sure that he arranges this with a friend of his. It's interesting, actually. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman has a bit of discussion about this in his Sefer Kovetz Shiurim. He says, we have a concept that when it comes to doing a mitzvah, a person is not obligated to give away all their wealth to do a mitzvah. To do a mitzvah saseh, the maximum a person is obligated to give away for a mitzvah saseh is an extra one third of what the normal price would be. A person can give one fifth of his money away for tzedakah. So what are we talking about? So are we saying over here? Yeah. Why over here? Are we saying all of a sudden he should be giving away his whole possessions? And basically, Rabbi Chanan answers, you're right. We're not saying he has to, but if he ever wants to eat kodeshim or enter the Beis Mikdash, this is the only way to do it. So we're not requiring him to, but we're saying this is the only way you're going to be able to accomplish that. Okay. Yeah.
The only time a carbon can be offered on a safek.
When you have chakas ha'oif in general, we learned about this quite a bit in various places in Kodeshim, a chakas ha'oif can be brought for a safek. Certain other carbonists, well, okay, one second. Many carbonists can be brought for a safek. For example, if you have a safek whether you have to bring an ola, no problem, because you're allowed to bring an ola voluntarily. You have a safek whether you have to bring a shlomim, no problem, you can bring a shlomim voluntarily.
We're not talking about voluntary
mistakes. No. We're talking about when a person has a suffix, one way of doing it would be to say, if I'm obligated in this carbon, then I'm bringing the animal as a chayva, and if not, I'm bringing it as an adava. It doesn't work for chatas. It doesn't work for osham. Although the Gemara actually brings up the possibility in Zvachim, why not? You have an opinion, we learned about in Krisus, that a person can offer an osham tolery every day if they want. The issue is,
We learned that
Bava Ben Butta did that. However, the Gemara points out in Zvachim that wouldn't work in this case. We're going to be dealing with the Osham here soon. But the Gemara mentions there in Zvachim that here that wouldn't work because the Osham of a Mitzvah is one of the two types that's a sheep under a year old. And Osham Toluy is one of the four types that has to be a ram over 13 months old. So you can't bring it as a Sophic. So we're going to get to soon what we do as far as the Osham, but right now we're dealing with the Hasa. So a chatas behema you can't bring for suffering, but chatas ois you could. Therefore, we have to make the guy be able to bring a chatas ois. How do we do that? We have to make him poor. Because the halacha is, without him being poor, the Mishnah tells us in the Goyim, if a rich mitzvah brings the korban of a poor person, it doesn't work. It doesn't accomplish what it needs to, and it doesn't any still machot the kafara. So the only thing is to actually make him poor. And how do you actually make him poor? By having him sign away all of his nechassim to somebody else, and then he becomes poor. Okay. Fine. So the question is, that's all fine and good. What do we do, though, as far as the osham? The fact of the matter is, we have the same problem with the osham, where his and Shimon's osham, ashamos, were mixed up. This is chatas we're talking about. But what do we do as far as the osham? The osham, either way, is an animal, whether he's rich or poor. You can't bring an osham for a suffix. So you have the same problem, therefore. If all three animals of Reuven's and all three of Shimon's were mixed up, then yes. So even if we make Reuven and Oni, we still have the problem. What are we doing as far as the asham is? If we can't say we're going to bring one osham on behalf of Reuven and one on behalf of Shimon, whichever one is which, because Shimon's dead. You can't bring an osham for a dead person. And again, you can't say that you can't bring an osham voluntarily. So what do you do as far as the osham? The answer is Shmuel says you're right. The case we're talking about over here has to be where the osham has already been offered. You're right. This statement of Rabbi Yeshua is that we can make it work by making Reuven poor. That will only work if the osham has already been brought. If the osham has not been brought yet, then yeah, you're stuck. So the question
has to offer the osham or the
osham? Actually, that's a good point. We actually have to offer the osham first. So therefore, so Shmuel was saying, that's the case over here. They offered the Ashamos. We only have four animals left, not six. And then those four animals got mixed up. So we don't have a problem mixing up which one is we know which one is the Osham and which one is the Ola. If we don't know that, if we also have mixed up which animal is which, whether it was the Chatos or the Ola, then you have more complications. But let's not even get into that. The point is, if we know which two are Chatos and which two are Ola, we just don't know which one is which is which person. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, so Shmuel says that must be the case where the Osham's already been brought. The problem with that is Omer of Sheshet. How could such a great person as Shmuel say such a thing that we're talking about that after the Osham was brought, and that's when we have to use, that's the only time we can use Rabbi Yeshua's solution? Because the question is, Kiman, which... Yeah, which Tana is Shmuel following when he says that? You have a machlokes between Reb Shimon, and Reb Yehuda, and as we're going to see, we're going to see the two parts of what Shmuel is saying. That number one, there's nothing that can be done as far as the Asham, and the other that he's saying that we're able to make him a poor person. Those two things, Reb Yehuda, we're going to see, Reb Yehuda and Reb Shimon each disagree with one of those things. E to Reb Yehuda, if you're going to say that Shmuel is saying according to Reb Yehuda, the Omer Osham cover, the problem is, Reb Yehuda says, once the Osham is brought, then it fixes things, then at that point, we go, in other words, the question is like this. We know that a Mitzvah, we know you have a poor Mitzvah versus a rich Mitzvah, and they bring different covers. What point do we look at the person's financial situation to determine whether he's an Oni or an Osher? We learned about this in Erchen and in Christmas, actually. That, do we say, we actually have a three-way machlokes about it. Do you go according to when the Osher is brought? Do you go according to when the Chatas is brought? And then we had actually the opinion of Rebbe Lezman Yaakov, who says even at an earlier stage, I'm all in the Gemara over here. That even in an earlier stage, when you first do the ceremony at the beginning of Parshas Matzora with the two birds and the piece of cedar wood and so on and so forth. So it's a three-way machloikis. So what happens, in other words, so the guy, let's say, was rich. The guy, let's say, was rich when they brought when they did the birds at the beginning. Then later on, before he has a chance to bring his korbanos, he becomes poor. Or another possibility is while he's bringing his karbanas, they bring his asham, then all of a sudden his house burns down and now he's poor, and now it's time to bring his chatas. What determines whether he's rich or poor? Rebbe Lezer ben Yaakov says you go according to the birds. So according to him, in other words, there's no way that making Reuven poor after the asham has been brought is going to help. He still was rich up until this point. Therefore, he has to finish bringing the karbanas of a rich person. And if he doesn't have the money for it, then he's going to have to save up for it. Rabbi Yehuda says, the Osham itself, when the Osham is brought, is what fixes things. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, once the Osham is brought, it's too late to make Reuven poor. Because even if he becomes poor, he still has to bring the rest of the korbanos of a rich person. So then he has to be bringing an animal for the chatas, and then you don't have the whole solution about chatas alif. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, that wouldn't work. The kiven de kabbalah Osham bashirus, once the Osham has established that he's considered an usher, loy moksi maisi chatas bedalu. At that point, he's no longer able to bring the chatas in as a poor person word, meaning a bird. And we know this gitznan. We learn in a Mishnah in Negoyim, mitzorda shehevi korban oni. If a mitzorda brings a poor person's korban, the hasher, and later on he became rich before he had the chance to bring the whole korban. Oy osher v'heni, or the other way around, he was rich and then he became poor. Hakol ha'olach achah chatas divrei Reb Shimon. Reb Shimon says it all depends on what his status was when the chatas was offered, which is the second korban.
Right.
Yeah, then you have the oil. So, well, fine. Reb Yehuda, I'm hakol ha'olach achah osham. Reb Yehuda says it all follows the osham, which is the first korban. Right. Reb Lezman Yaakov, I'm hakol ha'olach achah tzipporim. Reb Lezman Yaakov says that the tzipporim come before any of the korbanos. The tzipporim take place, but come a week before the osham. Again, you have the first stage of the Masoret Tara is the two birds ceremony. Then afterwards, he shaves, he waits a week, and then on the eighth day, he brings his korbanos. So the birds, the whole birds thing takes place over a week before he's bringing his korban. Well, they're not considered a korban at all. They're not even done in the Azara. It's a stage of his tara, that's all. It's a stage of his tara. So the point is, in other words, that Rabbi Yehuda would say that Rabbi Yehuda would say that once the Osham is brought, it's too late to turn him into an Oni. He's still considered an Osher. He still has to bring the Chatas and the Ola as an Osher, and that means we can't use Rabbi Yeshua's solution. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, we can't say the scenario is the Osham is already brought, because according to Rabbi Yehuda, then it's too late to use Rabbi Yehuda's solution, to use Rabbi Yeshua's solution.
Rabbi Yeshua, what does he say?
Rabbi Yeshua just said that you make Reuven an Oni.
No, but when do you have to bring...
Well, he didn't say. Rabbi Yeshua didn't specify. Rabbi Yeshua just said, in this case, where the korbanos were mixed up, we make Reuven poor, and then he brings a poor person's korban. But now, Shmuel, one second, Shmuel had added, because we had the problem, what do we do as far as the Asham? Shmuel said, we're talking about where the Asham's already been offered. So now the problem is, according to Rabbi Yehuda, then it wouldn't work. Because according to Rabbi Yehuda, once the Asham is bought, it's too late to change its status. And the E could have Shimon to Amachakas cover, Afagab the Lekar of Asham. And if you're going to say, according to Rabbi Shimon, who says that you could bring, that the Chakas fixes his status, even though he has not yet offered the Asham, so in which case you could say, okay, then Shmuel's, then what Shmuel's explaining, what Rabbi Yehuda's solution would work, because then according to Rabbi Shimon, you brought the Asham, but it's still, you have time to change his status. The problem with it is, Nesi Asher, according to Rabbi Shimon, we don't have to be talking about where the Asham's already brought, because according to him, even if the Asham has not been brought yet, you could still use Rabbi Yeshua's solution, because he can bring a second Asham. And now, you can't bring an Asham as an Adaba, it is true, but what he could say is that if this animal is needed for my Asham, then good, and if it's not needed for my Asham, then I will bring it as a Shlamim. Because, after all, unlike a chatas, where you can't bring a chatas as an adaba, but there's no other korban that has the blood applied to the mizbeach in the same way as a chatas. We learned in Zvachim that you apply the blood of a chatas by daubing with the finger on the four corners of the mizbeach, as opposed to most other korbanas are shtayim shein arba, sprinkling directly from the basin onto the two opposite corners of the mizbeach. So to take an animal that should have bring a chatas and say, I'm bringing it, if it needed to be a chatas, then it'll be a chatas, and if not, then it'll be some other type of carbon, you can't do that. But Rav Shimon says, when it comes to an Asham and a Shlomim, you could do that.
They're interchangeable
to the extent that they're both shechted in the same way. Okay, an Asham must be shechted on the north side, a Shlomim doesn't, it's a big deal, and the blood is applied to them as they act the same way. Now, there are key differences between them as far as who can eat them and as far as when they can be eaten and where they can be eaten. That we're going to get to on the day. But we know an Asham is Kodshim is Kodshe Kodshim. It can only be eaten by male Kohenim, only in the Azara, only on the day the Korban was brought and that night. As opposed to a shlomim can be eaten by any person, male or female, Kohen or Yisrael, anywhere in Yerushalayim for 2 days and the one night in between. But Rav Shimon, as we're going to see on Amud Beis, is not concerned about that. So therefore, according to Rav Shimon, so that's what Sheshet is asking. Shmuel is saying the scenario is that the Asham's already been offered, and now we're dealing with the other two korbanos. But if you're talking according to Rav Yehuda, once the Asham's offered, it's too late. And if you're talking according to Rav Shimon, there's no reason to mention that the Asham was already offered. Rav Shimon would be fine with Rav Yeshua's solution, even if the Asham had not been offered yet. And how do we know that? The Hashem in the Leila Rav Shimon to Omer Laisi, where we find a case where Rav Shimon says that you're able to bring a korban, which is a suffix whether it's an Asham or not, and the last knee, and you're able to make a tanai. The Tanya, namely, we learn in a Braisa, Omer Rav Shimon. So we have the context over there is a complicated case, actually, where a person has a suffix whether he was a nazir, he had a suffix whether he became Tomei or not, and on top of that, he has a suffix whether he's a Mitzvah or not. So you get into a whole complicated case over there where he winds up having to shave four times, and he winds up having to bring four different sets of korbanos to cover all the various possible permutations. He might have been a Nazir Tomei, he might be a Nazir Tahor, he might have been a Mitzvah, etc. The point is that at one point during that scenario, Rav Shimon says, Lamacharis, the next day, after he does one of his shavings, maybe Ashamay v'Lugayimay, he brings his Asham, which he would have to be bringing as a Mitzvah, the Lugayimay, he brings along with it the Lug of oil that he has to bring, that goes along with the Korbanos of the Mitzvah, Umamide v'Shar Nikonor, he places the Korban in front of Shar Nikonor, which is where he stands, because being a Mitzvah, he's not allowed to enter the Beit Mikdash yet, so he just stands in the doorway over there and sticks in his thumb and his ear and whatever. Umasna olav, and Rav Shimon says, then he makes a tnai regarding this animal. Volume, and he says like this: in mitzvah, who if I've actually been a mitzvah, because remember, the stuff is mitzvah. Hare asham of the luga imay. Okay, then here's my asham, and here's the luga of oil that goes along with it. The im lav, if not, if I wasn't actually a mitzvah, and therefore I'm not supposed to be bringing an asham. Asham zeh yeh shalmin adava. Instead, this asham will be brought as a voluntary shlomim. As a voluntary shlomim, which you can do. And by the way, the log of oil also can be that he's bringing it as a voluntary carbon. According to Rav Shimon, you can make a tonight between an Oshem and a Shlomim. But Oisai Oshem, now what happens with that Oshem? We have to put on it the chumras of an Oshem and a Shlomim. Namely, we're going to have to shecht it on the north side of the Azara, just in case it is an Oshem. We also have to apply the blood to the ear and thumb and toe of the Masora, again, in case it's an Oshem. Usmicha. On the other hand, we have to do smicha on it, which is, Rashi explains, there we're applying the chumra of a shlomin. Had it been an osham, then you don't do smicha on it. You don't do smicha on the osham of a mitzvah. But you do smicha on the shlomim of a voluntary shlomim. Tosfos actually disagrees with that, because Tosfos points to a Gemara that we learned in Menachos that says that actually an Oshem does require smicha. However, Tosfos says you actually have a machlokes, which we learned about in Zvachim, whether it's daraisa or not. An Oshem does require smicha, although it's machlokes whether in the case of an Asham Masorah, whether it's daraisa or not. So Tosfos says over here actually what it means is when we say tone smicha, what we would mean is like this. We can't do a full smicha, which is pressing on it as hard with the chol koichai, because it might be an Asham Masorah, and according to the opinion that the smicha of an Asham Masorah is only Dirabbanan, you don't do a full smicha on it, because that would be inappropriately using kachim, you just rest your hands gently on it. So therefore, that's the kind of smicha you would do over here. Okay.
For a regular Asham,
you wouldn't. Okay. So it needs smicha. Unesachim. It needs an esachim that go along. It needs an esachim that go along with the carbon. That actually Tosfos points out. I mean, there's no. Usually, I mean, here, usually an oshem isn't accompanied by an esachim. Here, we're talking about the oshem of a mitzvah. It does require an esachim. So really, there's no difference. So, yeah, it's the only type of oshem that needs a shlomim. That needs nesachim. So yeah, when we're mentioning nesachim over here, we're kind of mentioning it for completeness to say, really, it's going to need nesachim either way, because if it's an asham, it needs nesachim, and if it's a shlomim, it needs nesachim. Utsnufa, it's also going to require tsnufa, which is waving, v'chod of a shoik, and it's going to require that the breast and thigh are given to the kohen, or are waved, actually, they're given to the kohen regardless, because if it's a shlomim, then they're given to the kohen, if it's an asham, the whole thing is given to the kohen. What we mean is, in other words, when it comes to an asham mitzvah, first of all, you have something where it's waved while it's alive. We learned in Menachos, you have the sheep that go with the Shalmet Sibur are waved while they're alive, and also the Oshem of the Metzorah is. So we have to do that. And we have Tnufas Chol V'Shoik. On the other hand, in case of the Shlomim, we have to wave the Chol V'Shoik separately after it's okay. V'nechal Zichri Kohuna L'Yom V'Layla. And the next thing is, it can only be eaten by the male Kohenim for only one day and one night. In other words, in case it's an Oshem. So according to Rav Shimon, though, the bottom line is, you can do that. You can have an animal which is sophic oshem, sophic shlomim. You can be bringing it in case I need it as an oshem, then it's an oshem. If not, I'm bringing it as a shlomim. And Rav Shimon says that works. So therefore, that's what we're saying. The question is, though, why is Shmuel saying that our scenario involving the two mitzvahs, whose korbanos are mixed up, necessarily has to be after the ashamas were brought? If you're going according to the Shimon, it's not necessarily the ashamas were brought, because according to the Shimon, you have a way of fixing up the ashamas as well. And if you're going according to the Yehuda, once the ashram has been brought, it's too late to change the status. So that's the question. Which Tana is Shmuel following when he says, once the Oshem is brought, then we can use Rabbi Yeshua's solution, but not before that. It doesn't seem to work according to Rabbi Yehuda or according to Rabbi Shimon. V'loi hoidu lo chachamim Rabbi Shimon, continues the Braisa, the chachamim disagreed on that whole concept with Rabbi Shimon. Mipnesha may be kodshim l'beis ha'psul, because the result of it is that you're going to bring kodshim are more likely to become possible. When, like this, you're reducing the amount of time it can be eaten, the place where it can be eaten, and the people who can eat it. So therefore, you have a much higher likelihood that the meat of that korban is going to end up becoming nicer. So the Chachamim say you can't do that. So the bottom line is, again, that according to Reb Shimon, it shouldn't be necessary that the Ashram was already brought. And according to Reb Yehuda, if the Ashram has already been brought, it's too late. So that's Reb Sheshet is asking, how could Shmuel say that once the Ashram is brought, that's when we can use Reb Yehuda's solution? That doesn't work according to either one of them.
According to Reb Yehuda, it doesn't work.
According to Reb Shimon, it's not necessary for it to be after the Ashram. It could be before the Ashram.
Yeah.
Fine, but Shmuel is saying it only works after the Asham, so who's that like? The answer is Shmuel Savalak Reb Shimon Bechal.
Shimon say it can be either case.
Yes. The answer is Shmuel Savalak Reb Shimon Bechal or Polygalay Bechal. The answer is you're right. Shmuel agrees with Reb Shimon on one din and disagrees with him on the other. He agrees with him on the idea that against Reb Yehuda, that the Asham is not what's Kaveya things, that when the Asham has been brought, there's still time to change his status until the Chafas is brought. But he disagrees with Reb Shimon when it comes to the question of bringing an Asham as a possible Asham, possible Shlomim. He disagrees with that. He says, look, the Chachamim, who say you can't do that, it's an aim of being Kodshim of Beit. So therefore, now Shmuel is able to do that because both of those are machloikas in of Reb Shimon and Reb Yehuda. So therefore, Shmuel is entitled to pick a side in each individual machloikas. So therefore, it comes out. So
you have to pick someone. No,
because unless the two opinions of Reb Shimon or Reb Yehuda, unless we were to say if we hold like Reb Shimon in one, like Reb Yehuda in the other, they contradict each other, then we can't do that. We learned that before. We have, for example, cases where we have machlokas b'shamay b'tzilo about a din in Hilchos Tumah v'Tahara, which also has implications as far as the halachos of Tzreifus, where if you were to go according to b'tzilo in one of them and according to b'shamay in the other, then it comes out that you're being self-contradictory.
But here
the two machlokas are not tied to each other. The machlokas about whether you can bring something as a possible osham, possible shlomim, and the machlokas about whether the osham is keveya or the chatas, those have nothing to do with each other. So Shmuel is entitled to follow Reb Shimon when it comes to the osham not being keveya. So therefore, even though the osham has been brought, you still have a window of opportunity to change his status by making him poor. On the other hand, he disagrees with Reb Shimon about this idea that before the osham was brought, that you should be able to make a t'nai, that I'm going to bring an animal if it's needed as an osham, it's an osham, but it's not. He says you can't. So therefore, according to Shmuel, the only time that Rabbi Yeshua's solution will work is after the chatas is brought. But you're right. But you're right. According to Reb Shimon, it could be either before or after. And according to Rabbi Yehuda, necessarily it would have to be before. And then according to Rabbi Yehuda, you'd still be stuck because what do you do as far as the osham?
Shmuel agrees in totality with nobody.
Right.
Agrees partially with Reb Shimon and disagrees partially with Reb Shimon. And he fully disagrees
right.
with Reb Yehuda.
No, he agrees with Reb Yehuda in one thing and disagrees with him in the other. He agrees with him that you can't put in something as an Asham that could instead be a Shlomim.
Okay.
But he disagrees with him about which one is Kedeah, the Asham or the Chacham. Okay, so those were the three Dibrei Chachma people of Alexandria after Reb Yehuda. Okay. Now let's go on to next. Shloisha Divrei Agada. Next, they asked him three questions of Agada. Again, Agada meaning over here primarily when we're talking about things of how Hashem relates to people and how Hashem relates to the world. Number one, they asked him, you seem to have a contradiction. You have a pasuk in Yechezkel that Hashem says, I don't desire the death of the dead person. In other words, I'd rather the person does tshuva. Well, in other words, the simple meaning is, well, one thing is he can be called a mess while he's alive because Rishoyim b'chayim kri mason. You have the famous idea that Rishoyim can be called dead while they're alive because Baruchnius, they're dead. Right, but even though physically they're alive. But you also, it's interesting, actually, Marsha over here mentions that the Pasuk might be hinting at the idea of Gilgul. We have a person's neshama was originally in one body, and now he's in another body. So Hashem is saying, this neshama is now in a second body. I don't want that the person who already died one time should have to die again. I'd rather he does tshuva and that he accomplishes what his neshama is supposed to. Anyway, the point is, the pasuk is saying that Hashem doesn't want a person to die. A person wants a person to do tshuva. But the cost of echadim, on the other hand, you have a pasuk. In connection with the sons of Eli, you have the story over there at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, how the sons of Eli, Chofni and Pinchas, are disgracing the Korbanos and doing various other Averis and whatever. And the Pasuk says that their father Eli, because whatever the reasons were, but they were doing the wrong thing. They were taking meat from the korbanos before they were supposed to, and they were delaying bringing people's korbanos and whatever. They were treating the whole avodah of the korbanos very 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 disrespectfully and very casually. So the pasuk says that Eli, their father, tells them, gives them mussar about it, and the pasuk says that they didn't want to listen, ki chafet Hashem la'anisam, because Hashem wanted them to die. So it's a stira. Does Hashem want the person to do tshuva? Because the pasuk says, ki chafet Hashem la'anisam. So what is it? Does Hashem want the person to do tshuva, or does he want the person to die? So that's they're asking him. How do we reconcile this? The answer is he answered them, kan ba oisin tshuva, kan b'shein oisin tshuva. It depends whether we're talking about a person who's going to do tshuva or not. We know that even though a person has b'chira chafshis, we know that Hashem still knows what they're going to do. In this case, Hashem knew that the sons of Eli are not disposed to listen, and they're not going to do tshuva. So therefore, Hashem wants them to die as soon as possible, and that way they don't have a chance to do more of it. As opposed to a regular person who there's a chance that they're going to do tshuva, then Hashem wants them to do tshuva. Actually, Tosfos brings over here from a Sifri that answers the question differently. That's going to use the answer that Rabbi Yeshua uses for the next one. That there's a difference between before the Gzar Din and after the Gzar Din. That before the Gzar Din, Hashem wants the person to do tshuva. After the Gzar Din, then not necessarily. But okay, Tosfos says then that the Gemara didn't want to use that. Rabbi Yeshua didn't want to use that the answer over here. Because it's the one thing, obviously, before Gzar Din, you don't even need a pasuk to tell us, of course, Hashem will accept tshuva. Okay. Anyway. Fine. So that's question number one. Right. So what it means is, in other words, in the case, for example, of Bnei Eli, it doesn't mean that had they done tshuva, Hashem wouldn't have accepted it. Hashem will always accept tshuva. But Hashem wasn't giving them the opportunity. We know that Amma mentions in Hilchot Tshuva that sometimes a person has done such serious aseiras that Hashem, so to speak, takes away their bechira chafshis. They now don't have, Hashem doesn't give them the opportunity to do tshuva as much as they would have before. They still have the ability, if they really power through. Classic example is by Paray, right, where it says, I'll harden Paray's heart. So it means to a certain extent he lost his bechira chafshis. Had he done tshuva, it would have taken a tremendous superhuman effort, much more than he was willing to put in. In other words, the normal situation is a person does aveiros, and Hashem makes it. Every so often, the person will feel a twinge of regret or whatever, and they can use that to do tshuva. When it comes to a certain kinds of reshoyim, what Hashem will do is they'll take away that where they're never going to feel regret. So if somehow something moves them, something unusual moves them to, then fine, they'll do it. But it's not. Right, but in other words, they still have, the Alter Rebbe stresses this in Igeres HaTshuva, they still have the ability to do tshuva, they just are not being given the opportunity to, like a regular person would. Okay, so anyway, so that's what it is. Right, okay. The second question they had was like this. Kosev echadoy mekilo yisa ponim vola yikach shodchad. The one pasuk says that Hashem does not favor people, and he doesn't take bribes. Yis aponim, right, meaning to lift up somebody's face, which is an expression in Lashon Kodesh meaning to show them favoritism. So Hashem doesn't show anybody favoritism. Another pasuk says Hashem will lift his face towards you. In other words, that Hashem will show you favoritism. So what is it? Does Hashem show favoritism or not? So Tosfos says the question is not really on a pshat level, because the word yisa Hashem ponav elecha, in the simple sense, it doesn't have anything to do with showing favoritism. It means that Hashem will, Rashi says on the pasuk, okay. It means Hashem will show you favor. Hashem will, so to speak, like show you a smiling face or whatever. But still, they were bothered by the expression noisit ponim in both contexts. Given that it's true, it says Yisa Hashem Ponav Elecha, Ponav, his face, but they were considering it almost as if it says Ponecha, Hashem will show you favoritism. So what is it? So does Hashem show favoritism or not? The answer is Kan Kodim Gzar Din, Kan La'acha Gzar Din. It depends before the Gzar Din or after it. Before Hashem has signed and sealed the decision, then Hashem can, so to speak, show favoritism and decide favor. Well, in other words, fine, you know, even though this person deserves this punishment, I'm going to give him a break. But after Gzar Din, then not. Okay. Tosfos gets into a bit of discussion about another angle on it, maybe it has to do with Jews versus Goyim, whatever, but basically the Gemara over here is taking it that they within Jews themselves, it depends before and after Zagin. Okay. Next. The third question they asked was Kosov Echad Omiki Bacha Hashem Tzion. You have a prophet that says Hashem Tzion. So that's the conclusion, therefore. So that's the conclusion, that there's a difference before Gmar Din, Hashem can, so to speak, show favoritism and decide that, let's say, for example, this person, on the grounds that they've done many great mitzvahs or whatever, therefore I'm willing to give him a break and then give him another chance. On the other hand, after Gmar Din, then Hashem, after Gmar Din, then Hashem doesn't do that anymore. Okay, so exactly the Mila we're talking about, yeah.
Not the
Mila. Yeah, we're talking about Zaudin and Hashem that Hashem decided. Okay. Fine. The third question was they said like this. We have a pasuk that says that Hashem chose Tzion. The Tzion meaning the Yerushalayim, the site of the Mikdash and everything. So Hashem chose it and loved it. The cost of Achadomer, on the other hand, you have a pasuk in Yirmiyah where Hashem says to the Nabi.
It means
Yerushalayim specifically, yeah. Sometimes it means only specific area of Yerushalayim or whatever. The cost of Echadim, on the other hand, you have a pasuk where Hashem tells Yirmiyah, Ki al afi v'al-chamasi ho'itzali ha'ir azayit. This city has been a place that's angered me and made me furious. L'min ha'yom ha'shabonu oysa adayim azeh. From when they built it until now. So what is it that Hashem choose Tzion as his place, or was he upset by it from the beginning, from when it was built? The answer is, Kan kodim shenotha shlomes bas parei, kan la'acha shenotha shlomes bas parei. One pasuk that's talking about before Shlomo married bas parei, we know that among Shlomo's many foreign wives was the daughter of parei. We know, we've talked about before how the Rambam stresses that he was Megayer all of them, of course, because you're not only he wouldn't have married them while they were gorgeous.
But you cannot negay someone if you want to marry him.
Ah, so therefore, so the Rambam says they were negay by bote dinim shel hadyotis, basically by bote dinim of simple people. No, it is a valid gear because they did accept the mitzvah. They were told about the mitzvahs and they did accept them. But nevertheless, the bote dinim should have checked more carefully into their motivations in general. I mean, it's not just to marry, but in general, you're not really supposed to. In general, it says they weren't supposed to accept gerim during the times of Jagad and Shlomo. Because it could be that they're joining the Jewish people in order to join in the Jewish people's prosperity and whatever. Anyway, the point is, leaving all that aside, you have another issue as well, which is that the Torah tells us a ger from Mitzrayim is not allowed to marry into the Jewish people until the third generation. So you have an opinion, you have the opinion of Rav Shimon. Right, you have the opinion of Rav Shimon in Yevamos that says that life with Amorim and Me'ovim, he says it applies only to males, not females. So therefore, according to so Shlomo could have been marrying that. But nevertheless, though, it was still considered a bad thing that he married her because in terms of that, the halacha is not like Rav Shimon, the halacha is like the Chachamim. But besides that also, that a male or female mitzvi ger is also to intermarry into the Jewish people until three generations. But besides that also, we see that in the end, Shlomo's wives went the wrong way, and they misled him, and then they went back to worshiping their idols, their deshkas, and he didn't protest. And the prophet even considers it as if he himself worshipped those idols. So all told, it was a bad thing that he married her. But before he married her, then Hashem chose Tzion. As opposed to after Shlomo married Bas Parei, then Hashem is saying from then on the city is a source of anger to me. So actually, the Marsha says, so what do we mean? But still, why are we using the expression Lamin Hayemesha Bonu Oisa from when they built it? Yerushalayim was built as a city long before Shlomo married Bas Parei. So he says that Shabonu Oisa actually doesn't refer to the building of Yerushalayim, but rather the building of Rome. We have the famous Gemara in Shabbos that tells us that when Shlomo married Bas Parei, then Malach Gabriel came and stuck a stick into the Mediterranean, and dirt started gathering around it, and eventually that basically became the site of Rome. So Marsha explains what the Pasuk is saying is, this city of Yerushalayim has been a source of anger to me ever since, because of what they did in Yerushalayim, the city of Rome started getting built up.
What they did in
Yerushalayim in Shlomo's times, by Shlomo marrying Bas Parei. Well, Shlomo is the king of the Jewish people, so the Leva Melech will Leva Kolam.
He caused
that. Yeah, that caused the beginning of the rise of the Romans. Exactly. The Aruch HaNer says it a little bit differently. The Aruch HaNer points out this psukim that men.
David HaMelech also did certain things with Bathsheba. That even caused the anger of.
First of all, he did tshuva for them. He did serious tshuva for them, and Shlomo apparently did not. Right. But so that's an important difference. But okay. Anyway, the Aruch HaNer says another tack on it. He says you find psukim that say that before Shlomo married Bas Tara, there was this large open area in Yerushalayim called the Miloy. And that says that Shlomo built up the Miloy and then closed up the wall of Yerushalayim in that place. So like, so to speak, Yerushalayim was not fully built up until then. When they fully built up Yerushalayim, that's when it became a source of anger to Hashem, which is at the time he married Bas Tara. The connection is, because the Gemara in Sanhedrin, actually, where it says that Yerubam, no less, criticized Shlomo for that. He said that, because he said, like this, you had a wide open place over there that the Oyler Rego could come through easily. Now you closed it up so that when there's a gate over there, now you can charge people tolls as they go in and out of the gate. But whatever, the point is that Aruch HaNer says that's what goes with our Gemara. Not we're talking about the building of Rome, like Marshall says, but we're talking about when Yerushalayim itself, when a certain part of Yerushalayim that up until that point had been unbuilt, now was built, which coincided with when Shlomo married Bas Tara and started building a palace for her over there. That's when Yerushalayim became a place for Hashem.
One is Rome
and the other is Yerushalayim. Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so those were the three Divrei Agada that they asked of Yeshua. Next. Shloisha Divrei Burus. Then they asked him the three things of Burus. There are Mephoshim who discuss why, because the Aruch HaNer, for example, has an explanation that each one depends on the previous one. Okay. But I didn't look up the exact details. But with that said, actually, you're right. Hagori Tabach actually changes around the order. He says the one about Kilo Yisaponim comes first, the one about Kilo Echbos comes second, and the one Kibachar comes third. Because then they go in the order of the Pesukim. Okay. Next, Shloisha Divrei Burus. The people of Alexandria, the Jews of Alexandria, asked Rabbi Yeshua three divrei burus. Number one, Ishto Shalot Ma'usha Tatame. Lot's wife, when she became a pillar of salt, is that still Matame? Amalahem, he answers them. Amalahem, Mes Matame Ve'in Nesiv Melach Matame. So he says to them, only a dead body is Matame, a pillar of salt is not. So what's going on over here? Marsha, who explains that the Divrei Burus, so all they're asking things based on philosophy, he explains that basically they weren't sure. Okay, we know that Hashem turned her into a pillar of salt. Fine, we accept that. But do we still say that, they were asking, do we still say when Hashem transformed her into salt, is it a complete transformation, or is it that there's something of her body still like there, like not like under the surface, so to speak, but like maybe it hasn't been completely transformed? Because like according to Greek philosophy, you know, or to a certain extent, according to modern science also, right, matter can't really be created or destroyed, right? It can be transformed from one form into another, but you're always going to have like something that's... You're always going to have something that evokes the original substance, kind of. So he tells them, no, you're wrong. You're misunderstanding it based on your Greek philosophy. You don't understand. When Hashem transforms something, it's not just that it's a superficial transformation. It's not just that you could conceivably reverse it and get back to what you had originally. No, it's completely transformed into a whole new substance that wasn't there before. In this case, it's a Netziv Melech, it's not a bomb.
There's only salt. And therefore it
can't be metabolized. Right. So we'll talk about, after we learn the three questions, then we'll talk about the fascinating sticha where the Rebbe analyzes this in some detail. Okay. The second question they asked is, Ben Shunamis Maushi Tame. We know we have the story of this, it's an Akhtara of Parshas Chayesara, where you have the woman from Shunem who was a great Machnes Orach, and she was Elisha's host several times, and then Elisha benches her with a baby, and sometime after that the baby dies, and then she goes all frantic to Elisha, and Elisha goes, and then Elisha goes and revives.
Shunam is
meaning, she was a Jewish woman from Shunem.
Shunam
is a city in Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Anyway, so the question is, Ben HaShunamis, this baby of the son of the Shunamis that Elisha revived, Mahu Shiitame, is he Matame? In other words, like this, at one point he was dead, now he's alive again, is he Matame, like a dead body? So the answer is Amalahan, Mesh Matama, Van Time Matama. He says, no, only a dead person is a family, a live person is not. So Marshaw here explains that it was a similar question. They were saying, very nice, Elisha brought back a spirit of life into him, but after all, our philosophy tells us that dead is dead, so therefore maybe that's it. Dead is dead, and therefore if he's alive, it's only like a superficial thing, and there's still something of death that still attaches to him, and therefore he should be Matama. And he tells them, no, you're wrong. When Hashem does a nest and Hashem brings a little life back into him, it's a 100% transformation, not like you think only a 99% transformation.
They were saying that basically it cannot be done. Once it's dead, it's dead. It cannot come back to life.
Sort of. Then the third question was, Mason, what offset love it, Shrichen Azov, Shlishu Shvi, Ain Shrichen. The Mason, the people who come alive by Kesa Mason in the future, will they need to be sprinkled with Paradim or water on the third and seventh or not? In other words, again, are they coming mess or not? Amalahan, so he says to them, L'shiyichu nechakim lahen. When they come alive, then we'll be smart enough to know the answer. In other words, on the surface, he's saying, I don't know the answer at this point.
So why he knew for...
Wait. Why do you know by the other two when he doesn't know by the other?
Right.
Another question you could ask is, we know in Pirkei Avos it says that a chacham mashal lo shama, I'm a lo shamaiti. He should say lo shamaiti. What do you say? Like, one day we'll find out the answer. He should say flat out, I don't know. Right. So wait. Ikad Amri, another version, he said to them, l'chshiyove Moshe Rabbeinu imahem, when Moshe Rabbeinu comes with them, then we'll know the answer.
So that's obvious.
Well, okay, so now we can talk about what the Rebbe talks about here. So now we'll talk about what the Rebbe talks about in the Sticha, in Chelek Yud Ches, where the Rebbe analyzes this whole story in great detail. Basically, the Rebbe explains like this. First of all, like I was saying before, when we call these things Divrei Burus, objectively, on the surface, they're not Divrei Burus. On the surface, there's a depth to them. But when you analyze them more carefully, then you find out, regardless which way you take about it, then you're gonna come up with the same answer. So in that sense, it's Divrei Burus, like these distinctions that you're trying to make are not, in fact, valid distinctions, I'll be told. So the first one they ask him is like this. So basically, the question is, he says, all of these questions are surrounding the question like this. What is it fundamentally that makes it, when we say that you have a concept of Tumas Nes, what's the fundamental thing that triggers that? Is it that the neshama left the body, or is it that the body itself has to be a dead body? Which means, in other words, for example, the difference is, first of all, we know, let's say, we learned in Chulin, that you can have, let's say, a limb that's dangling off a person, even though it doesn't have enough vitality to continue living, it's not metame. So therefore, we see that there's, because you have to have the whole chayus left, and now the whole chayus hasn't left the person yet. On the other hand, we also learned previously, in Armasecht, actually.
Right?
We learned that in Cholin. On the other hand, we also learned in Armasecht, I think. We also learned previously in Armasecht that, let's say, you have a body that is indisputably dead, but it was burnt, let's say, and now it's in ashes, and now it's in pieces, then it's not metame anymore. So their question was basically along these lines. In the case of Lloyd's wife, is it that once the neshama leaves, then immediately you have the remaining body is metame, or is it that you have to have a body there? You have a body from which the neshama left. And then I would point out, you have such things in other cases in halacha. You have, for example, by Mila, you have the discussion, for example, what's the primary thing of Mila? Is it that there has to be an action done to remove the Arla, or is it the primary thing the person should not be an uncircumcised person? And you have things that come up in halacha. There are differences in halacha. Is there an action that has to be taken? What's the important thing, the action or the result? There's two ways of looking at it. So
the result, sure.
Right, but that's the question. Is it the action that's the more important thing, or that leads to the result, or is the result the more important thing? Anyway, so they're asking over here by Ishka Shalois, and the question is then, if we say the thing is that you have, if you say that you have, the main thing is you have a dead body, and the cause of that was that the neshama left the body, okay, then we're going to say, of course, you don't have a body over here, therefore the body's not the family, because all you have here is a pillar of soul. But if you say that the main thing is that the neshama left, then after all, Lloyd's wife's neshama left her, therefore the body should be metame. So he answers them it doesn't really matter. It doesn't. It's a very nice svara that you have this distinction between the cause and the cause and the effect.
Is there remnants of life or not?
Well, that's what I was saying according to Maharsha. That was according to Maharsha. But wait, here we're talking right. So the first right. So he says to them, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter whether it's because the neshama leaves or because the body is left after the neshama is gone. Either way, you don't have a body left over here. You have a pillar of thought left. Therefore, divrei burus. Therefore, regardless, you have this very nice chesel that you could argue there's a difference. But over here, it doesn't come out a difference because either way, what you're left with is a pillar of thought. By the case of the Ben Ashunamit, he says, and by the way, Mephoshim asks the question, Toysus actually asks the question, other Mephoshim asks the question, the Tlach, for example, asks the question, there was an earlier case involving a baby that was revived. We have Eliyahu Hanavi revived the Ben Asurfis. You have the woman Ben Asurfis that he was staying by for a period of time, and her child also died. One distinction is that by the case of the Ben Asurfis, if you analyze the psukim carefully, he didn't necessarily die. He was in a deep faint or something. Or even if you say that his neshama, Eliyahu has to daven over there that his neshama should return to him, implying that the same neshama is going to be returning to him. You could say he was dead, but the same neshama is returning, as opposed to by the Isha Ashunamis, you don't find that Elisha doesn't daven for his soul to return to him. Elisha has to actually breathe a new neshama into him. So now the question becomes, given that it's a new neshama, then again, you have the question, what's the main, so what is it? Do we look at the fact that the neshama left him in that case, and even after it came back, okay, but you have the neshama left him, therefore you should be metame, or do you say that not? And again, he tells him a divrei burus, because either way, the fact is the result is the same, either way it only applies to a dead person, and here the fact of the matter is he's not dead anymore, he's alive. Then by the third question, by the Mason Lost in Lava, the question boils down to, and here the Rebbe refers to Uliyahu Mephoshim, who says the question is basically whether when the neshama itself comes back to life, you have, as it's coming back to life, its pieces are coming back together, so therefore you have one piece is touching the other. So does the person become Tameh? You have a sort of like we had discussions in previous Gemaras about, for example, the other way around, let's say when you're ripping a cloth, and the parts of the cloth are touching each other just before they get detached. So are they metame each other at that last point? So here you have the other way around. As the limbs are coming back together, does the person become tame as a result of that from the limbs touching each other?
Regarding the ashes of the Holocaust,
let's talk about that later because let's finish up over here. But no, the fact is, ashes are not metame. Okay, so the Rebbe answers. So to continue with our Gemara over here. So the answer is, Rabbi Yeshua tells them like this. The question basically boiled down to, there's two ways of looking how Tchiyat HaMeisim is going to happen. One way of looking at it is that there's something left over from the original body. Classically, we talk about the Esem Luz, the Luz bone that's left over, and the whole body is rebuilt from that. The other way of looking at it is that there's nothing left of the original body, and then it has to be reconstituted all from fresh. So if you say that there's something left, then that etzem loses the tame, and therefore, as the body is being reconstructed, then everything else that touches it becomes tame. If you say that not, then not. So therefore, they don't ask the question metame anymore. They're asking, using the expression tzrichin hazah. We know that we're not asking the question about the din, whether touching is metame or not. We're asking the question, what's going to actually happen? How is Tchiyat HaMeisim going to happen? In a way where one piece touches another, or in a way where it's being completely reconstituted? So then Rabbi Yeshua answers them when he says to them, L'chshivaru nechassim lahem, he's not saying, I don't know the answer. He's saying the answer is actually going to depend on how Tchiyat HaMeisim takes place. And right now, we don't know. Hashem can choose to do Tchiyat HaMeisim. How Tchiyat HaMeisim, which one of these is going to be the case, right? Tchiyat HaMeisim. Is it, there's two possible ways of Tchiyat HaMeisim. One, that the body is reconstituted from the Luz. One, that it's completely rebuilt from without anything being left. And that would answer your question about ashes of people that were burnt in the Holocaust. One way of saying it is that the Luz is left over. The other way of saying it is that nothing is left, but Hashem reconstitutes it and you actually have one of the Achronim, the Ein Eliyahu, who says that when he says L'chshivaru nechassim lahem, he means we're going to have to decide on a case-by-case basis. But the Rebbe and the Sikha over here is taking it a slightly different way, that Rabbi Yeshua is telling them it's going to depend on how exactly it happens then. Not, I don't know the answer. If the answer is that it's built from the loose, then the answer is they will need Hazar. If the answer is that they're going to be completely reconstituted, they won't. We don't know yet which one it's going to be. When they actually come alive, whatever, we will be smart enough. Then we will find out how Chiasimaisim took place, and then we'll have the answer to the question.
And by the mere fact of recalling it Chiasimaisim, we're coming from the net.
Not necessarily. Yeah, that's fine. But how is that?
Not necessarily.
And the Rebbe brings over here from Midrashim that say that one way of looking at it is that you have the entire body decays and decomposes, and then Hashem rebuilds it out of that, Okay, let's finish up over here. The point is, with the Holocaust, either you can say the loose bone was left over, because the loose bone is indestructible,
okay,
or you could say it was not. So you have two different ways of understanding. Is the body going to be rebuilt from the loose bone? The loose is a bone from a dead body. If they're completely rebuilt, that's also tchiasimaisim. It's also tchiasimaisim because they were dead, and now they become alive. So therefore, so that's what he says. When tchiasimaisim actually takes place, then we'll know what actually happened. And when he says, he's talking specifically about the Meisim Midbar, the Jews who died during the 40 years in the Midbar. What is going to be the method of Chias and Meisim with them? That depends, he's saying, whether Moshe comes with them or not. There's two ways, again, two possible ways of Chias and Meisim, which depends, therefore, on what their level was, and that depends. If we see that Moshe comes with them, then we'll know that they're on one level, and if Moshe doesn't come with them, but he comes before or after, then we know that they're on a different level.
Which is lower.
Which is lower, right. So therefore, right. So if Moshe comes with them, then it shows that they have a chelik lo'olam haba. Therefore, it shows that something was left of them, the etzem luz, then they're going to need hazar. Whereas if Moshe does not come with them, it means they have to be completely reconstituted from nothing, from the tarvud rakov, and in that case, they're not. In that case, they don't need hazar. So that's the answer. The first answer, is talking in general about all the Mason that have ever been. All the Mason of Jews that have ever been. The second one, is focusing specifically on the Mason people. So in a nutshell, that's the Rebbe's explanation. Okay. And it's time to matter.